Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited to finally have an opportunity to interview Walden Bellow. Walden Bellow, I've been hearing for some years, and he's always so interesting. He's director of Focus on the Global South, which has offices in the Philippines, Thailand, and India. He's also a professor of public administration and sociology at the University of the Philippines. So I want to welcome you and say how excited I am to have this opportunity. Your latest book, Walden, and you have a lot of books, but the latest one is called The Future in the Balance, Essays on Globalization and Resistance, and it's edited with a preface by Anuradha Mittal from Food First. Let's see some other books. Global Finance, New Thinking on Regulating Speculative Capital Markets, A Siamese Tragedy, Development and Disintegration, Modern Thailand. I could go on and on because, Walden Bellow, you've been at this for a long time and just are always busy doing lots of great things. So why don't you, if you would, please explain what is Focus on the Global South?
Well, I'd also like to thank you, Sue, for allowing me the opportunity to talk to speak at your radio program. And Focus on the Global South is it's an analysis and advocacy and what we call a capacity building institution that is based in Bangkok, Thailand. We focus on the ecological, economic, and political impacts of globalization. We try to come up with works that try to illuminate all the contradictions happening under globalization. And we also try to engage in movements to resist corporate-driven globalization. And we try to work with grassroots groups in terms of creating commonly the analysis. Not only the analysis in terms of the critique of the key institutions like the corporations and the U.S. states, but also what people need to do, what people usually call thinking about the alternatives. So that's what Focus on the Global South does, and we've been in existence since 1995, so we're now in our seventh year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an awful lot. I would love to focus a little bit on the alternatives, because I hear people complaining all the time that they never hear what to do. I think that, you know, first they have to have the information about what's going on, and then we tell them what to do. But maybe we'll just start out with some positive alternatives to the things that are happening in the world as a consequence of globalization. And I'm sure you can sum up the negative effects of corporate globalization real quick and then get on to some positive alternatives that you work on.
Well, I think what we have been saying for all along, I mean, quite a number of people within the progressive sector, since the 70s and 80s, people like Susan George, Cheryl Payer, Robin Broad, Jan Kavanagh, the Institute for Policy Studies, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, Food First, we had been calling attention to the greater food insecurity that was coming about because of globalization and free market economics, the greater inequality that was being produced, the crisis brought about by structural adjustment programs pushed by the World Bank and the IMF in the Third World. And so the critique is not new. What is new is that, especially over the last 3 to 4 years, it's now been listened to. People are now listening or accepting this critique in a much broader fashion, that lots and lots of people have begun to accept the fact that these negative aspects of corporate-driven globalization are in fact true. And people like Jeffrey Sachs, for instance, of Harvard University, many of the intellectuals of the establishment, including Joseph Stigler, who used to be the economist of the World Bank, chief economist of the World Bank, are now buying our analysis. And so I think that what we're saying is we've been saying for some time, and I'm really glad when Joseph Stiglitz and people like Jeffrey Sachs, who used to be such establishment economists, I'm glad that they've finally caught up with the analysis of people like Susan George. So right now, therefore, I think that, of course, we continue to have, the IMF and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization and the corporations continue to push their agenda. But I think more and more that agenda is being questioned by broad masses of people. It's seen as illegitimate. What we're seeing is a crisis of legitimacy on the part of the institutions of the establishment. And now, even as people call attention to the problems of these institutions, they are also at this point raising the question about alternatives. And, people gathered in Porto Alegre in Brazil over the last 2 years in order precisely to try to present a different vision of the way society should be organized. So there is a lot of ferment. People, are experimenting with local currency systems. There are places throughout a number of places in the world that are model communities, ecological communities, for instance, like Gaviotas in Colombia. There are groups like fair trade groups that, in fact, are creating trade links between communities across borders so that they don't have to depend on middlemen. And there are paradigms that are being presented about how what we really need is a situation whereby the market is subordinated to the values of equity, of solidarity, and democracy. We're talking about groups that would like to bring down production to the local level. So there's a lot of thinking, and the principles for alternative structures of society are there. It's a question of how do different communities, including national communities, create national strategies based on these principles that would subordinate the market and the pursuit of profit to the larger social goals. So that's where we're at this point in time.
Well, that's really incredible. I didn't know that these people from the World Bank were changing their minds and coming around to thinking more in the interest of just ordinary people. What happened?
I don't want to give that impression. It's defectors from the World Bank, very prominent economist intellectuals who have basically turned their back on their institution and says that their institution is not, in fact, doing good, resolving poverty issues, because they've got the wrong model. So these are just a few. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they're quite prominent and they've defected creates a crisis for the institution. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to hear. And I guess it's people, these issues are more and more in people's face. I mean, as they're faced, more and more people are faced with literally starvation. Although there's already a lot, this looks like there's going to be a growing in number with
well,
all the...
Yes, I mean, this, the World Bank itself says that the number of people between, I believe between 1998 and 2000 or 2001, the people living in poverty in the world rose from 2.5 billion to 2.8 billion. So the 90s... were a disaster in terms of growing inequality, in terms of more and more people throughout the world living under the poverty line. So 2.8 billion living and existing on $2 a day. That's the definition of the World Bank on poverty. But, you know, of course, if that's your definition of poverty, I mean... that is really, really a situation of extreme poverty. I think that people living on $5 a day, I think, would be considered poor. So actually the figures or the statistics that the World Bank gives us does not, in fact, adequately capture the numbers of people that live in poverty. I mean, it's an arbitrary definition to say that below $2 a day is poverty and beyond that is not poverty. I mean, come on. I mean, we all know how people, with prices becoming equalized throughout the world because of globalization, it's so difficult to, you know, for ordinary people in developing countries to be able to live on the equivalent of $10 a day, $15 a day. That's becoming much more and more and more difficult with the equalization of prices because of, you know, the flow of global capital and the flow of global trade. So yes, we, you know, the situation when it comes to poverty has in fact gotten worse. Mm-hmm.
And of course, that those measurements are by according to the money economy, and people lived better before they got in. There were some people before they even got into the money economy, which is a whole subject in itself, which kind of segues into sustainability in a way, Walden Bellow. And I know that you've written a lot, and you do a lot of work around the issue of sustainability, which is a word that's become fairly common in my vocabulary, but probably a lot of listeners. Don't really know even what it means. So if you could just speak a bit about that.
Well, sustainability is really, I think this is a concept that has come out of the environmental movement that says that, you know, economic growth should not destroy the base for the survival of future generations and should not, in fact, should create a good basis for the future. So sustainability means that we have to end a sort of strip mining type of growth that creates so much environmental damage, which is irreversible, and which in the long run will affect the economic capacities of our planet. So sustainable growth or sustainable development basically means... those strategies that promote environmental integrity rather than destroys the basis for the survival of future generations. And I think that sustainability would mean, would have a number of different dimensions. One, of course, is the technology that we use. It's got to be green technology. And that I think more and more we're beginning to see that green technology is affordable. It's just that the big corporations are not putting money into research on green technology, precisely because if you have renewable sources of energy, then you put a lot of the oil and gas business out of business. So. The other thing is scale, that the scale and the huge centralized industries have to be decentralized so that they're more responsive to the needs of communities. It's not sustainable to have a global food system in which the average dish that people eat in the north travels 2,000 miles before it reaches their plate. I mean, that is crazy. Why have food travel 2,000 miles, and each of those 2,000 miles means, including air, when you look about air or boat transport, there are all sorts of costs to the environment of each of those miles. So that is not sustainable. A global food distribution system where food travels thousands of miles to reach your plate, and in the process creates tremendous accumulated environmental damage, that's not sustainable. It's not sustainable to have wide divergences in income in society, because what wide divergences in income does is that creates tremendous poverty and inequality, but creates tremendous instability, and both ecologically and economically, because economies can only survive if there is purchasing power on the part of people. Once poverty kills that purchasing power, then economies go into decline. So sustainability, therefore, has social and ecological dimensions.
My guest is Walden Bellow. Walden Bellow is Executive Director of Focus on the Global South. He's based in the Philippines, where he's also a professor at the University of the Philippines, a professor of public administration and sociology. And he's written many, many books, the most recent one being The Future in the Balance, Essays on Globalization and Resistance. And you can find that book in bookstores. So, Walden Bellow, it also, I was thinking as you're talking, of course, all this issue of oil is not only it's actually killing lots of people, as this whole war thing is just getting bigger and bigger, and the United States waging war essentially on the world on top of all the other horrible things going on. And I would like you to talk about what's going on in the Philippines, what's going on in Asia, since you know about the whole world, but mm-hmm. we don't hear so much about that. So I understand that that's on Bush's list of places to where terrorists are hiding, and I know that there was some stuff going on in the Philippines. What's happening now?
Well, basically, the Philippines, after Afghanistan, and the Philippines the United States sent troops to the Philippines ostensibly in pursuit of the war against terror, and there is a group there that operates, which is its ideology is supposed to be radical, fundamentalist Islamic, but it's mainly a bandit group, and it's called the Abu Sayyaf, and there were no links after 1995 that were proven between the Al Qaeda organization of Osama bin Laden and this group. Nevertheless, we saw was that the United States sent troops to the Philippines, and they've been there about 160 special forces, backed up by another 1,000 American troops in western Mindanao and in this island of Basilan, where they've been participating in a domestic law and order situation.
which means repression, usually law and order, huh?
Yeah, right. I mean, basically, that is the task of the police forces of the Philippines. But what we have seen now is that the United States is intervening in police problems and under the pretext of going after terrorism, where, in fact, there is no proven link between this group and the Al-Qaeda group. So I think there's a lot of apprehension throughout the world about the way that the United States pretty much has defined the war against terror to include almost everything, that every form of dissent could be, you know, potentially be labeled war against terror, and that there is almost no check on the ability of the United States to send troops to different places. Of course, the Philippine government of President Macapagal Arroyo, in fact, agreed to have the U.S. troops there. But again, we must look at this as being part of a deal, and that the United States basically said, "Well, we're going to give you billions of dollars if you allow us to participate in terms of going after this group in your country," so that there's a mercenary aspect to this whole thing. The Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines, despite the fact that the U.S. troops have been with them since January training Philippine troops, they've not managed to destroy the Abu Sayyaf because these are internal problems. These are domestic problems. They have a local base. They're supported by people high up within the provincial government. And you cannot have a military solution to these issues. And this is what the United States is trying to do now to, its approach to many issues throughout the world that have to bear on security is always a military solution. And what we're seeing is, in fact, that people resist the military solution because these are intractable problems. It really needs a care, negotiation, peaceful approaches to be able to resolve many of these problems that we have. Military solutions may seem to work in the short run, but in the long run, a situation is worse than before.
Right. Well, in fact, they don't even seem to work most of the time. I wonder, Walden Bell, if you think there's another agenda, or if this is just kind of barking up the wrong tree and thinking that a military solution is going to even change things, or I'm putting words in your mouth, or thoughts in your mind. Do you think that even the intention of having a military solution, so-called, is sincere, or do you think something else is going on?
Well, I think what's going on here is the United States is there in the southern Philippines, not only to establish a presence that would surveil what it considers now to be strategic enemies of the United States, which is Islamic fundamentalism, but to also monitor and create the capacity to intervene in Malaysia and in Indonesia, which are countries where the Islamic movements are on the rise. So basically, what we have here is the creation of a virtual base of operations for intervention against Islamic groups in the region. Now, of course, the Philippines is also important as a military outpost for the containment of China, because the United States, in fact, regards China, or the Pentagon regards China, as the strategic enemy of the United States. So I think we have to realize here that the global deployment of forces by the United States, oftentimes the stated purposes are not just the purposes, but a lot of it is following us what the Pentagon considers to be a strategic imperative. of making sure that the United States maintains military hegemony in different regions of the world. So I think that this is the way that we've got to look at this.
Mm-hmm. And actually, even digging a little deeper, do you think it's really about Islam? Is that really the issue?
No, I think the problem really is that, you know, people are getting very resentful and opposing the structures of inequality and hegemony that benefits a very small group of countries and states within the world economy. And that this resentment has many manifestations. It's manifested in Islamic movements. It's manifested by revolutionary movements. It's manifested by reform movements. It's manifested by civil disobedience. So what we're at now is really, we've got to look at the fact that the United States feels very threatened by the growth of critical movements, of movements. They may be secular, they may be religious, but they're all very threatening to the power of the United States. So this is really not about religion in the end. It's about resistance to power and the fear of those in power of this resistance. So this is what we always need to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. You know, we only have about a minute left, but I realize that we never talked, Walden Bello, about what you mean by the global south. So mm-hmm. I should have asked that first question, but you are director of Focus on the Global South, and I imagine a lot of people mm-hmm. don't understand what that term means and why you use it. So if you could say something about that real quick, and then folks get ready for how to contact.
Well, the South is now a term that's used as an equivalent for the third world, meaning that countries south of the equator tend to be, most of them, I mean, except for a few, are also the poor countries of the world. Now, when we say global south, we're saying that this country south of the equator plus the oppressed people, oppressed classes in the north. That, in fact, there is a third world in the north in terms of people who live in poverty and are structurally marginalized by the system. So there is a global south. That's what we mean by this, of people throughout the world, whether they live in the north or in the south, that are marginalized by the current systems of or institutions of inequality.
Okay, well, thanks so much. I want to let you know how what the webpage is, of course. It's the usual www, then FocusWeb, FocusWeb.org, FocusWeb.org. So that's how you can get more in touch with what the Focus on the Global South is doing. And thank you so very much, Walden Bello.
Okay. Thank you, too.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.